From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet actor Jared Harris. He was described in the New York Times as becoming one of the most fascinating actors around. He played Andy Warhol in I Shot Andy Warhol, a Russian cab driver in Happiness, and John Lennon in the VH1 movie Two of Us. Jared Harris stars in the new independent film Shadow Magic as the Westerner who brought silent films to China in 1902. Also, rock historian Ed Ward on Pub Rock and linguist Jeff Nunberg on the origin of a word that's supposed to ridicule pretentiousness but is often used by pretentious people. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate voted today to support a ban on so-called soft money in political campaigns. Senators are in their second week of a debate on campaign finance reform, considering legislation proposed by Senators John McCain and Russ Feingold. The McCain-Feingold bill calls for a total ban on soft money, which is unregulated money contributed directly to political parties by individuals, corporations, and labor unions. Today, Senator Chuck Hagel, a Nebraska Republican, proposed an amendment that would allow such donations but limit them to $60,000 per person per year. Opponents said the amendment would undermine the McCain-Feingold bill, and it was rejected on a vote of 60-40. President Bush was in Kalamazoo, Michigan today talking to local business leaders about his tax cut proposal. In his speech, the president said his tax cut is needed to stimulate the country's economy. Michigan Public Radio's Matt Schaefer Powell reports.
Speaking at a Kalamazoo Chamber of Commerce luncheon, the president defended the size of his tax cut plan. $1.6 trillion, he claimed, is neither too big nor too small. And he was unapologetic when he addressed critics who claim the plan targets wealthy business owners.
It's important to always remember the role of the federal government, or any government for that matter, is not to try to create wealth. The role is to create an environment in which the entrepreneur can flourish.
Bush encouraged members of the crowd to contact Michigan's Democratic senators, both of whom favor a more moderate tax cut. From Kalamazoo, the president headed back to Washington, where the Senate could begin debate on a tax cut as early as next week. For NPR News, I'm Matt Schaefer Powell in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
California power regulators have approved the largest boost in electricity rates in the state's history. The Public Utilities Commission unanimously approved a plan that would raise rates by as much as 46% for customers of the state's two biggest utilities. The Walt Disney Company joins a number of big-named companies forced to downsize. It says it's cutting 3% of its workforce worldwide in response to a softening economy. NPR's Mondalit Del Barco reports from Los Angeles.
4,000 full-time employees will soon be out of work. Officials at the Walt Disney Company say they'll ask for volunteers to quit in the next month, but they may need to lay off workers. In a letter addressed to, quote, fellow cast members, Disney chairman Michael Eisner said the company had been trying to contain operating costs and operate efficiently, but that the slowing economy proved too much of a challenge. The cuts would reportedly save up to $400 million a year for the company, which is based in Burbank and operates Disney theme parks and retail stores around the world, the Disney Movie Studio, ABC, and ESPN television networks. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The Dow gained 260 points today, or 2.6%, to close at 9,947. This is NPR News. There was more violence today in the West Bank and Jerusalem. Palestinians say Israeli troops shot and killed an 11-year-old Palestinian boy as he stood on a rooftop to watch a gunfight in the West Bank town of Hebron. The Israelis say they have no information on the shooting, but they confirm that Israeli troops exchanged fire with Palestinians in the area. Yesterday, a Palestinian gunman killed a 10-month-old Israeli girl. Earlier today, Palestinian militants set off two bombs in Jerusalem, injuring more than 30 people. A two-day Arab summit opened today in Amman. Representatives of the 22-member Arab League are focusing on two main themes, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and the lifting of Iraqi sanctions. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Amman.
In morning speeches, Arab leaders stressed the summit's main theme, support for the Palestinians in their six-month uprising against Israeli occupation. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat said his people had been subjected to collective punishment by the Israelis. "You are our only hope," he said, referring to the Arab heads of state. The Palestinians are urging Arab leaders to fulfill financial promises and speed up badly needed funds. The summit host, King Abdullah, called for the lifting of UN sanctions on Iraq. The issue has been a divisive one in pre-summit meetings. Enemies, Kuwait and Iraq, have yet to agree on a common stand. Officials are hoping to forge a compromise on the sanctions issue before the summit's end. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Amman.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index gained 54 points, or 2.8%. It closed at 1972. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novosoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Would you like to do a screen test?
Yeah.
You would?
Yeah, I would.
Really? Could we do one now?
That's Jared Harris as Andy Warhol and Lily Taylor as Valerie Solanas in a scene from the 1996 film I Shot Andy Warhol. It's the film that made many of us realize how good an actor Harris is. Further proof came with the film Happiness, in which he played a Russian cab driver who was a seducer and thief. The cast of Happiness won the 1999 National Board of Review Acting Ensemble Award. Harris played John Lennon in last year's VH1 movie, Two of Us. His other films include Lost in Space, Dead Man, Smoke, Blue in the Face, and Natural Born Killers. He grew up in an acting family. His father is Richard Harris, his stepfather Rex Harrison. In the new film Shadow Magic, Jared Harris stars as Raymond Wallace, a Westerner who introduces silent movies to China in 1902. It's based on historical accounts of the period. Here's a scene from the beginning of the film in which Wallace has shown up at a busy photography studio in Beijing and interrupts everyone's work to announce his arrival and the arrival of a new magical technology.
My name is Raymond Wallace. Raymond Wallace. Ni hao.
Ni xiang gan shenme?
My business, yi yang, the same. Wo de gong hao, better. Wo de zhao pian, my pictures, nong dong. They move. Mingbai? Xin Fa Ming. Living photographs that move. It's a worldwide phenomenon. Picture.
Hello.
Oh, you speak English.
Hello.
You speak English.
Leader. Speak Chinese better.
Yeah. He understands.
Jared Harris, welcome to Fresh Air. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your character in Shadow Magic?
The character in Shadow Magic is based on about five or six real people. The Western governments at the turn of the century sent representatives out there, salesmen essentially out there, to corner the market in cinema in China. And they pretty much all across the board all went out there with very little knowledge of China, no Chinese skills and language and in understanding the customs, all failed miserably. Most of them crawled back home broke. And this character goes out there really to make money. He's a merchant. He's failed at home, his wife has left him, and his fantasy is that he goes out to China, makes a killing, comes back home with lots and lots of money and status, and that his wife will see what a success he is and crawl back and beg to be taken back. You know, some sort of stupid fantasy like this, which of course he doesn't achieve at all. Instead, he through his association with this character, played by Xia Yu, who's a photographer's assistant, who is an artist himself, He learns how to use this new medium as a sort of modes of expression, and then he gets banished from China and bequeathed the equipment to Xia Yu's character, who ends up making the first Chinese movie, which is historical. This person in real life did make the first Chinese movie back in 1902.
How did you get this part?
Someone, I don't know who, pulled out at the last minute, as is often the case in with movies. And so I got the script and was told, a script is arriving, you have to read it tonight. Tomorrow, if you're interested, the director will call you up, and if the phone call goes well and you're interested and she's interested, then you're going to get on a plane at the end of the week and head out to China.
And do you ever feel like, well, if they really wanted me, they should have called me the first time around?
No, but not at all. I the people that they're talking to, they kind of work their way down a sort of a list of, the list is sort of a mixture. It's not necessarily to do with ability. It's to do with, although very good people on the list, it's as much to do with fame, you know, as it is to do with ability. So yeah, that's just part of the business side of making movies, is you've got to have a name up there that has marquee value, you know, and you can get marquee value in many different ways.
Does your name have marquee value?
But it had some, but there were a lot of other people on top of me on that list. They said it would have come to me first.
The movie that I think you first became really known for was I Shot Andy Warhol in 1996. And this movie is about Valerie Solanas, who wrote the Scum Manifesto and actually shot Andy Warhol, seriously wounding him and nearly killing him. Lily Taylor played Valerie Solanas. You played Andy Warhol. How did you get the part?
I auditioned. I knew it was a part that they would cast an English-speaking actor, I mean, an English actor for. Generally, when you're over here, if you're English, you tend to get the parts that, this just sounds a bit silly, not that nobody wants, but, you know, you get the kind of odd parts, the character parts, or the sort of, the kind of, the villain parts. So I knew this was an American role, which was an important thing for a foreign actor working this country to get, is to try and get your first American roles, you know? So, I was all gung-ho to try and land this part and played some little mind games to get it.
What did you do for the audition?
I went in and met them first, and I had a beard and everything, and I deliberately tried to look as unlike the guy as I could, and then said I'd like to come in, but don't ask me to come back in 2 days' time or 3 days' time. I said, give me 2 weeks or 3 weeks to really focus on this and try and get it right, and you'll have an idea of how close I can get. And and if you've got any material, the tapes and stuff like that, then I'd love to get that, because that'll give me a cut short my that process. So, which is what I did. I studied for a couple of weeks, and I came into the audition, and I thought it would be too weird if I sat down talking as I do now and then suddenly put on this persona. So I went in and did the whole thing as Andy. And then I thought, well, he would do something to try and flip the tables on these people, because he didn't like to be put on. He liked to be in the spotlight, but not having it pointing at him. He liked to be pointing the spotlight. So I was trying to figure out how to turn the tables, and I got hold of a little video camera and made a movie of them auditioning me.
Now, you play Andy Warhol as if he's pretty disconnected from his body, and almost as if his body doesn't have much weight or energy.
I thought that's true, looking at the photos of him and seeing him move around. I think he'd become pretty disappointed in his sexual experiences, and I think he hated the way he looked, and he hated his body. He didn't like the way it looked. As before he got shot, I think he's deteriorated greatly after he got shot. But I also noticed that in all of his pictures, he always covered up his crotch.
Huh.
You always see him the way he stands. He's always sort of covering it up.
Gee, what does that mean to you?
I think that he was uncomfortable and was disappointed in the act of sex, and was in some way disappointed in his physical being, you know.
Well, that disappointment in the act of sex comes up in the scene that I want to play here. This is a scene that takes place at one of Andy Warhol's party, and everyone at the party is in a kind of druggy trance, or they're dancing. And Warhol is the outsider, even at his own party. He's just watching everyone else. And in this scene, he and Valerie Solanas are sitting next to each other on a couch. Here's the scene.
Hi.
Hi.
Gee, everyone's having such a good time. Would you say something for me?
What?
Yeah, I have an hour's worth on tape here, you know, and I was just wondering, maybe you could just do a monologue for me.
No, I mean, I can't just monologue like that. I mean, I need a stimulating person like yourself, you know, to talk to. I can just do it on my own.
Oh, come on, Batman. Say something dirty. That's so easy for you. Let's talk about sex. Sex is really nothing, isn't it?
I could read you something from my latest masterpiece, Scum Manifesto.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Sex is the refuge of the mindless. Sex is not part of a relationship. On the contrary, it is a solitary experience, non-creative, a gross waste of time.
Oh, so true.
I think this scene has what you were talking about when he says that he thinks that sex is really nothing. Mm. Tell me about the vocal inflections that you used as Warhol. That kind of
you
flatness.
Mean the accent.
Well, not the flatness, not the accent so much as the kind of flatness with which he speaks.
Well, I listened to a lot of audio tapes, and then luckily the first day of filming that I was there, Billy Naim was on set, and he gave me a whole bunch of clues about how to do that. His particular rhythms and patterns, but when he was in public, he had a public and a private persona, definitely, and he played Andy Warhol in public, and it was this very blank, flat, non-responsive, almost like a white screen for people to project onto. But when he was in private, he was very chatty and a big gossip. So I tried to distinguish between those scenes where he was in public and in private. And that was a scene where he was in public. He was talking to a stranger, you know, and he was in this big, big party scene. But the other scenes in the movie where he has this sort of breathless quality where he can't decide which sentence he wants to start first, and he starts about three of them, and he gets all, he jumbles all this stuff on. And so I try to get both of those on, although the movie mostly dealt with his public persona.
What else did Billy Naim tell you?
He said he wished that we would leave the factory there for him to live in, the set that we had there, because it was exactly like it, and it was the best days of his life. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, they were crazy, crazy, crazy days. Our version of it naturally was was a kind of PG version of it. He said you were constantly finding people having sex in the bathroom, or having sex outside on the couch in the middle of, with people walking by. So he said it was wild, people doing drugs and everything, and you know, right out in the open.
After playing Andy Warhol, did you feel any more strongly about his art or his movies?
Yeah, I did. I definitely did. He was a very successful commercial artist, making a lot of money. And he abandoned that career to become a fine artist. And that's a really difficult thing for somebody to do in the middle of their life, if you like. Although it was early in his, but still, once you've achieved success in a career, to abandon it and become an artist and, you know, risk abject failure and poverty, that's a huge risk to take.
My guest is actor Jared Harris. His films include I Shot Andy Warhol, Happiness, Smoke, and Dead Man. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jared Harris is my guest, and his new movie is called Shadow Magic. Now, you had a great role in the movie Happiness, which was directed by Todd Solondz. You played a Russian cab driver who's a little like the Dan Aykroyd, Steve Martin, Wild and Crazy guys from Saturday Night Live. do you want to describe him?
He is a conscience-free Russian immigrant, comes to this country, presently driving a cab. Can barely speak English, opportunist, absolute 100% opportunist, who gets involved with Jane Addams' character, his teacher, his English teacher, and takes her for as much as he can.
Let's hear a scene in which he's using his cab to drive Jane Addams, his English teacher, home. And she's, by the way, now a regular on Frasier. So he's pulled up in front of her door, and before she gets out, he starts putting the move on her.
Why are you not married?
Oh, Vlad. Vlad, life is so different in America. Here, a woman can... I know this is difficult to understand, but a woman can fulfill her potential. There are opportunities to do something... do good, really improve the world.
Do you like men?
Yes, but it's not so simple.
Are you lesbian?
No.
It's all right if you are lesbian. I like lesbian.
This character of the Russian cab driver is really the opposite of Warhol physically. You know, where Warhol lives outside of his body and thinks that sex isn't what it's cracked up to be. This cab driver sees himself as macho and swarthy and the great seducer. Talk about the body language you got for this character.
There's a great, you got it. There's a kind of an arrogance, a great sense of pride, possession of space. A domination of his surroundings. Great fun. And like I said before, I think what distinguished him from every other character in that movie is he had no conscience whatsoever. I read an interesting statistic when I was studying for this character, which is that they did a study of first, second, and third generation families when families immigrate, people immigrate to this country. And the finding was that the longer you're in America, the more mental health problems you develop. And this guy hadn't been here long enough to be tortured by, guilt and conscience and he's doing the right thing or the wrong thing. I mean, he took a little bit, obviously, too far. He was a thief. But I enjoyed the idea that we have all these other people are tripping up all over themselves, over their desires, which they can't own up to. So it ends up, everyone is referred to in that film through sex, through their drive for sex or their ambition for love. And because they can't express it, it twists and contorts their personality and they end up... exhibiting deviant behavior and going about it in very strange ways, and some of them completely abhorrent ways, the Dylan Baker character. But this guy, he wasn't messed up about it, you know?
He just messed up other people.
Yes, exactly.
Who did you observe for this character? There was something so recognizable about him.
I live in the East Village, right in the thick of this Ukrainian neighborhood. So there's I used to go hang out in the Ukrainian bars and stuff like that and watch people. So there was no one specific person.
In the scene that we just played, you're wearing the shiny, clingy polyester shirt that's coming out of your pants. Who dressed you?
I forgot the costume designer's name.
But it was the costume designer. You didn't go to the store and find it yourself.
No. We consulted on it, but yeah. It was the costume designer. When I went in to audition for that part, I wore a really big, loud shirt. You see that in the neighborhood. You see, particularly on Sundays in good weather, what you see is a family. You'll see the husband, the wife, and the daughter. That's who I particularly sticks in my mind right now. The wife was dressed in furs. The daughter would be dressed in sort of hip Tommy Hilfiger clothes and would either be walking 5 yards ahead or 5 yards behind her parents, completely disgusted with them. And the husband would be in bright, shiny tracksuit top and tracksuit bottom. You know, like a gangster or something, you know, this sort of idea of a gangster. I thought this guy had seen, he'd come over from Russia and he'd seen all these, in Russia, he'd seen all these 70s American TV shows. And that that's what he was in, he had this idea, that's what America was like. He was kind of he was like a character on Starsky and Hutch or something, you know. So he had this idea in his mind of that's where he was living.
I love your description of the family each making their own statement through their clothing, and each of the statements is totally contradictory with the rest of the family.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, I think of you as being a real chameleon in some of your movies, and I think it's great for you as an actor. I think the only problem would be that people don't necessarily recognize you from role to role, and therefore it might be a little harder to build up a reputation for being Jared Harris.
Ding, 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 ding.
That's been a problem.
Absolutely. Good for the craft, crap for the career. It is. In this country, a good actor is confused with a famous actor.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, that's made it a longer journey.
Jared Harris will be back in the second half of the show. He stars in the new movie Shadow Magic as the Westerner who introduces silent movies to China in 1902. It opens in New York and Los Angeles April 6th, and then will begin opening in other cities. Here's another scene from the film in which Harris is talking to the still photographer who has become his assistant. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
China doesn't need more walls. Need someone like you to carry this magnificence to the outside world. Just think of it. You, me, recording life before it changes. Show it to the whole world. Might even go down in history.
A whole world? Huh? Where is that?
You leave that Photoshop and become my partner. The future belongs to the moving picture.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're looking for love. Just when the feeling is right, something goes wrong.
Coming up, Ed Ward remembers pub rock. Jeff Nunberg talks about a word that is used to ridicule pretensions, but is often used by pretentious people. And we continue our conversation with actor Jared Harris.
Should find love there, remember tonight. For everyone.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Jared Harris. He stars in the new independent film Shadow Magic, which opens next month. His other films include I Shot Andy Warhol, Happiness, and Lost in Space. Harris is the stepson of actor Rex Harrison and the son of actor Richard Harris. Richard Harris is known not just for his movies, but for his fluky 1968 hit record.
For us, girl, it ran one step ahead as we followed in the dance. Between the parted pages, and we're pressed in love's hot fevered iron like a striped pair of pants. This park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again.
This recording was made at the height of the hippie era. It's a song that people really love to make fun of, in part because of that kind of inane and bombastic lyric about someone leaving the cake out in the rain. Have you ever figured out what that means, by the way?
I knew you were going to say, what does it mean? What does it mean? It's a metaphor for a relationship.
Oh, okay. What did you think of the record when it came out, and what was happening in your life that year, 1968?
I was enduring my first year in a prisoner of war camp that was a private school called Lady Cross.
It was like a high school?
Yeah, it was a boarding school.
So everybody in the school must have known this. Did this help or hurt your reputation?
Did they know? I remember seeing him on Top of the Pops singing My Boy, but not that one.
Well, I guess it wasn't that big in England, huh?
No, it was, but it wasn't. I was at a boarding school. You know, you didn't have
radios.
You weren't allowed to watch television. You didn't have access to, you know, where would you hear it? You didn't have little record players or CDs or anything like that.
Well, when you saw your father and your stepfather acting, was it acting or the actor's life that you found appealing?
I wasn't aware of my dad being an actor when I was young. I remember. There was an Australian children's entertainer on television called Rolf Harris. And when I'd say my father was an actor, the kids would say, you know, oh, is he Rolf Harris? I'd say no, and then they would lose interest. So I was disappointed he wasn't Rolf Harris for a long time. But I wasn't aware of him as an actor. I had the benefit of both his success and my stepfather's success in being privileged to go and see a lot of the world when I was very young, you know. So that rubbed off, a taste for that rubbed off, definitely.
What were the Richard Harris and Rex Harrison movies that made the biggest impression on you when you were young?
I remember seeing Camelot. I do remember seeing Camelot and a film called The Snow Goose.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the first films he made that kids could go and see. My father mostly was in mature themed movies. Rex, I remember seeing him in Cleopatra. He played Caesar opposite.
That must have been fun.
Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah, I loved Cleopatra. Was great fun with all these battles and everything.
When you started acting, did you feel that there was anything you had to live up to from your father and stepfather's reputation, or that you would be compared to them in any way?
Well, obviously compared myself. It was important to me to establish myself on my own terms. I had opportunities to act with him very early on in the movie The Field. They had trouble finding somebody, and I was talking to the director about playing his son in The Field, and he was leery of it, and so was I. And I it was important to me for me to be established and recognized on my own right before I went and you know, I guess, went down that route, you know, tried to coattail, you know. I didn't want to do that. Otherwise, you know, I wanted to fail on my own terms. If I was used, you don't know if you've got, everybody has to think that they've got something special to get into this, because the chances of succeeding are so slim. If I had nothing special and I was going to fail, then I wanted to do it on my own terms and rather than sort of be fooled, you know.
Was there anything that you'd seen in your father or stepfather's careers that either influenced you or convinced you to do it differently?
Well, Rex had, and my father still has, incredibly successful, varied careers. So I'd be thrilled if I could get mine up to that kind of a level. I think the lesson that I remind myself is, it's not giving up. You know, they didn't want Rex Harrison to play the part of Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady when they were going to make the movie. They didn't want him for it. He'd played it on Broadway and he'd played it in the West End, but he wasn't a movie star. And so they were going to get somebody else, and they, of course, were campaigning for him to play this part. And so they demanded that he audition for it and send a photograph of himself in, you know. And they were trying to, you know, they put him through some fairly humiliating, or attempted to put him through some humiliating hoops to get this part. And he sent a photo of himself straddling over one of those little fountain, you know, those boys that piss into a fountain, you know. And he sent that in as his picture. They didn't want my father for the role in Camelot either, to play King Arthur. They wanted Richard Burton, and when he turned it down, they were going elsewhere. And he campaigned like hell to get that part. I mean, even to the point of tracking down Jack Warner in some party out in Palm Springs to convince him to give him a shot at this role, you know. So those are the things that I remember. When you see something that you know you're right for, go after it, and not to give up while you still have the desire and the ambition, you know.
Well, you really got your start, I think, in independent films, and you're still making a lot of independent films.
Sure.
Is that because it's the sensibility or the group of people that you gravitate to, or has it just been easier to get good parts in those films?
I tell you, I was out in L.A. in 93, and in 1 week I went up for a serial killer, the ghost of a serial killer, and a computer-generated serial killer. And at that point, I just said, I've had enough. And I wanted to... I was fed up with the opportunities that were available to me out there. They weren't... It was kind of like having a racehorse and then just have him trot around on some sort of country fair, you know, on a small padded circle or something. I'd been trained, and I wanted to stretch and see what I could do, you know. And it seemed to me that those opportunities were going to be in theatre and independent movies. So I made a point of coming back to New York, finding a place with really cheap rent, so that if I was doing a play for $200 a week, I could pay my rent. And concentrating on that, and hoping that
I'd get I'd be in movies that would break through, and that would allow me to do more interesting roles in bigger and better paid movies, you know. So, and in general, I just find the material is more interesting. They take better. They used to. It's getting harder and harder now for independents to do this, but the material used to be riskier, and they would try stuff that you just. In a studio movie, often you by page 10, you know exactly what's going to happen. You know who the good guy and the bad guy is. And the bad guy's unlike anyone you've ever sort of seen, because they're just, they're randomly, you know, vicious and unkind. For some reason, they feel compelled to get on the phone and tell the bad guy, the good guy, that they're actually alike one another and they're really brothers in spirit. At the same time, he's trying to rough up his girlfriend or something because, you know, it's all this stupid manipulation of the audience to make you like one character and hate another character, so when they decapitate them at the end of the movie, you can cheer. And that's my spiel on Hollywood movies.
Okay. Jared Harris, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Is that the end?
Yes, it is.
I've enjoyed it. Time just flew by.
Jared Harris stars in the new independent film Shadow Magic. It opens in New York and Los Angeles April 6th, and then will begin opening in other cities. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward remembers pub rock. This is Fresh Air. Can a whole genre of rock and roll disappear with no notice? It almost happened in the mid-70s with pub rock, an unpretentious but enjoyable twig on rock's family tree, which wound up preparing the way for punk and new wave. Rock historian Ed Ward has the story.
Despite its name, pub rock didn't start in a pub. It started instead with one of the biggest PR disasters in the history of rock and roll. In 1970, Brinsley Schwartz was an up-and-coming band named after their guitarist, blessed with an easygoing sound and a great songwriter named Nick Lowe. They'd been calling themselves Kippington Lodge, but new management saw great things ahead for them. So great that they got the band on a bill at New York's Fillmore East, chartered an Aer Lingus plane to fly a plane load of British press over for their debut, and the best laid plans and all of that. The band hadn't gotten work permits, the plane was delayed several times, leaving London and Shannon, and truth to tell, the show was awful. Back in England, the band retreated to a house in the country, but down in London, things were changing. An American band called Eggs Over Easy had gotten stranded in London, and because they wanted to play, they approached the owners of the pub across the street from them, the Tally Ho, which had been featuring Dixieland. The Eggs soon drew a crowd, and an idea was born. Soon enough, they were joined by other bands, including Brinsley Schwartz. And there were other bands, too. In an era where you seemingly had your choice between the endless soloing of virtuosos, the cerebral hogwash of the progressives, and the teen allure of the glam bands, there were some rock and roll fans who just wanted to put on a pair of jeans and hear a good band in unpretentious surroundings. And there were bands who wanted to play for them.
Well, feel free to knock my back door any old time. Scrubbing tables, sweeping floors, just washing all the line. You can slip around the
next time you're in town. It's music every night with a pun to help it down. The place.
If there was a manifesto, Bees Make Honey's Music Every Night would have been it. Ironically, though, the very informality and offhandedness of much pub rock was what put off a lot of people at the time. Few pub rock albums were ever released in the United States, and virtually none of the bands toured outside of the British Isles. Nor was the sort of modified country rock the Brinsleys and the Bees played the only sound in the pubs. Dr. Feelgood was basically a blues band from Canvey Island, an obscure corner of London, and in Wilco Johnson, they had a guitarist with a decidedly visual approach to the stage. They were incredibly popular and were one of the few pub rock bands to make it, albeit only in England. Then, there was Ducks Deluxe.
All right, kids, are you ready? Are you ready for the rock and roll? Yeah, I got a million brain from the studio.
The Ducks were a fearsome-looking crew, and heaven only knows what Sean Tyler was singing about at any given moment, but they left behind two supremely rocking albums. And, of course, there were the inevitable art students.
Here we go. Billy Bentley go to London early in the day. Half a quid, mate, stand to reason. Hold your horses, as your farmer. Well, go blimey, watch your cheeky. Move along there, see the show, sir. Nice time back.
But Kilburn and the High Roads weren't just any art students. Their lead singer was their teacher. Ian Dury later gave up teaching art for a career in rock and roll, while his fellow Kilburn and student, Humphrey Oceans, became a famous painter. There were more. The Kersal Flyers, Chili Willy and the Red Hot Peppers, and the one band in the whole bunch to have a U.S. hit, Ace. Strictly from a business standpoint, one could say that pub rock was a failure. There were few hits, nobody made any money, and it barely made it out of London, let alone the UK. But it also launched the careers of a number of people who'd go on to forge the next big thing to come out of England, the punk and new wave movement. And, just as importantly, it gave some of us who were disgusted with how boring rock music was in the 70s something to listen to.
Ed Ward would like to thank the Kersal Flyers drummer Will Birch, author of No Sleep Till Canvey Island, The Great Pub Rock Revolution, for his help with this piece.
Well, they danced, they have a tune the band could play. At just about midnight, when they decided to call it a day. Now there's one thing left here on their mind. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They've got a little slide.
Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on the pretentious use of a word that's supposed to ridicule pretensions. This is Fresh Air. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been following the use of a word that you might not yet have noticed, but if you did, you might not have known what it meant.
I picked up a copy of Commentary a while ago, and there was Norman Podoritz decrying the feminist doctrines that originated in what he described as the arcane lucubrations of marginal academics. That word lucubration seems to be a favorite of critics out to ridicule the pretensions of artists, intellectuals, and other self-important people. John Simon uses it of Wallace Shawn's plays, James Kirkpatrick uses it of the editorials in the New York Times, and the literary critic Joseph Epstein complains about the opaque lucubrations of structuralists, semioticists, and deconstructionists. The wonder is that the word is still around. It originally comes from the Latin for work by lamplight and refers to laborious study, or more generally, to any writing that's learned or pretentious. I first looked up the word a number of years ago when I ran into it in one of Dr. Johnson's essays. That's the nice thing about words like lucubrate, is that you can have these precise memories of your first encounters with them. But it was clearly a rare and mock pompous word even back in the 18th century. And by all rights, it should have disappeared when English gave up trying to refashion itself as a dialect of Latin. It should have gone the way of clankular, cubiculary, deuteroscopy, and the other Latinate mouthfills that Johnson filled his dictionary with. For some reason, though, lucubration has managed to cling to life in the penumbra of the English vocabulary, maybe because it smacks of the very pedantry it describes. I've never actually written the word myself. I've always thought of it as one of those items that you're better off just taking a quiet pride in knowing. But I can understand the urge to stick it in. It's a fine-sounding string of syllables. You have the feeling that whatever lucubrate denotes, it's probably a very good name for it. And as a word like that gets increasingly rarefied, it tends naturally to slip from its moorings and drift off on a plane of pure sound symbolism. Carried away on the assonance of all those U's, people start to use lucubration to mean all sorts of things. Sometimes it seems to mean just ramblings or banalities, and sometimes it means something like rummaging around. Even the redoubtable William F. Buckley used lucubrate incorrectly as a transitive verb when he described the defense attorneys in the O.J. trial as lucubrating a defense thesis. I expected Buckley meant something like dreaming up or conjuring up, but you can be sure that Dr. Johnson would never have used the word with a direct object. You could lucubrate on a defense, but that would have a different meaning. And there was an even more startling malapropism in a review of a Tom Wolfe novel that Norman Mailer published in the New York Review of Books. It contained the sentence, "No one will ever be the same after reading Wolfe's set piece on the massive copulation of a prize stallion with a thoroughbred mare after she has been readied for this momentous event by the lucubrations produced in her by the mouth and nose of a third horse, Sad Sam." I don't know exactly what Mailer imagined was going on in the mare, but it presumably wasn't scholarly musings. Probably he was misled by the resemblance to lubrication and lubricious. But it's notable that the gaffe eluded the editors of the New York Review as well. When William F. Buckley, Norman Mailer, and the editors of the New York Review of Books have all lost their grip on the meaning of a word, maybe we should think about putting it out to pasture. And while we're at it, there are other Johnsonian holdovers that we might want to give notice to, like lambent, etiolated, tergiversation, rebarbative, and jejune. Jejune in particular is almost always a bad idea. Of course, the second you propose dropping a word like lucubration, the friends of the English language will be up in arms to remind you of our obligation to preserve all the fine distinctions and shades of meaning that have been handed down to us. But those were gone a long time ago. It isn't just that most people don't have any context for a word like lucubration, but that whatever nuances it might have had once are washed out now by the pure resplendence of its syllables. When a word starts to sound that elegant, nobody can hear what it's trying to say anymore. Of course, none of this is going to stop people from using the words. They may annoy or puzzle most of the people who read them, but then when you see somebody using a word like lucubration or etiolated, you can be pretty sure that it wasn't stuck in for the reader's benefit in the first place. And sometimes you have to forgive a writer for indulging a love of big words, particularly when they're as delectable a mouthful as lucubration is. And even if, unlike Dr. Johnson, they're not flogging a dictionary on the side. But let's face it, it isn't communication, it's gargling.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Megan Howell and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Tariq Rose.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Wisdom of Menopause, Creating Physical and Emotional Health and Healing During the Change by Dr. Christiane Northrup. And from Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at saabusa.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, in this era of foot and mouth disease and mad cow disease, we praise vegetables with food writer Jack Bishop. His new book, Vegetables Every Day, is a guide to buying and cooking produce. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.